Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for February 12, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And this is not the introduction that originally went out on the broadcast because of a technical glitch. We lost the first 5 minutes or so of the live broadcast, and I'm re-recording this introduction the day after the fact for the internet version of the radio show. And if we still had the original, you would have heard me introducing the two guests for the night, the author of the book High and Mighty, The Dangerous Rise of the SUV, that's Keith Bradshaw, former Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times, and now with the paper's Hong Kong bureau. And then at the bottom of the hour, Michael Mann, the distinguished sociologist at UCLA, author of the book Incoherent Empire. And had we still had the original version, you would have heard me talking about the usual economic headlines that customarily begin the show with, starting with the U.S. employment report, which was released the previous Friday, which showed a gain of 112,000 jobs in the month of January, which was the best number we've seen in some time, the first six-digit gain in many, many months, but still rather a weak performance, about half of what we would see in a normal month based on the averages over the last 40 to 50 years, and about a third of the kinds of growth we would see in the early phases of an economic recovery. So the U.S. labor market improving slowly, but still performing quite below its historical averages. You would have also heard me talking about that Thursday morning's release of the initial claims figures, that is the count of the number of people who had just lost their jobs, who head over to the unemployment insurance office and file for benefits, a very timely and sensitive indicator of the state of the job market. That rose a few thousand last week, the second week in a row of increases, after a very, very long period of decline. And this suggests that while I wouldn't say it's the beginning of a new recession or a sharp rise in unemployment or anything like that, it does underscore the weakness in the job market and the anomalously weak nature of this economic recovery. You would have also heard me talking about the drop in the consumer confidence figures, according to the ABC News and Money Magazine weekly survey. And how this is tied in, I think, with the increasing trouble that George Bush is having in the polls as well. Again, not signs of a beginning of a new recession, but a sign of a rather troubled economic environment and people really feeling the pinch in their perceptions of the job market and their sense of their own personal finances. And you would have heard me talking once again about how the consumption in the U.S. Over the last several years of weak economic performance has been sustained not by the growth in wage and salary income, which is almost non-existent, but by people borrowing very heavily against the appreciated value of their housing, and how this looks like something that isn't really the key to long-term economic growth, but it is what's been keeping the U.S. economy afloat in the last several difficult years. And you would have also heard me talking about the OECD, the Paris-based think tank sponsored by mostly by the rich countries, but there are a few poorer members now, Mexico and the Czech Republic, but it's still dominated by the rich countries. And the OECD periodically publishes a set of leading indicators for its member economies, that is, indicators of designed to forecast economic moves 3, 6, 9 months down the road. And those are in a steady uptrend, with the North American economies showing the strongest increase, Europe and Japan showing weaker but still positive numbers. Mexico also showing weekly positive numbers as well. At least according to this measure, the world economy is improving and in some kind of recovery phase. but not a gonzo one. It's still the recoveries in most parts of the world are fairly weak. Certainly not evidence that we're at the leading edge of a boom or anything like that. And now let's move from this reconstructed introduction to the rest of the show, the 44 minutes or 45 minutes of which are intact. Japan are actually more weakly positive than the U.S., Mexico is also sort of flat, slightly up, but it does suggest that the world economy is in some kind of recovery phase, but hardly looks like a vigorous one. So we'll see how that continues. Today, Alan Greenspan, yesterday and today, Alan Greenspan gave his periodic congressional testimony on what the Fed is planning in monetary policy in the coming year. And Greenspan gave a mostly optimistic evaluation of things. He says the prospects are good for a sustained expansion of the U.S. economy. The last year appears to have marked a transition from an extended period of subpar economic performance to one of more vigorous expansion. He doesn't seem to be too worried about the fact that people have been borrowing very heavily against their houses. He says that the rise in prices justifies that kind of behavior. The rise in house prices justifies the borrowing, which is a very optimistic way to interpret it. Greenspan has also been saying that the housing market is in nothing like a bubble. He was also saying that about the stock market a few years ago. And he turned out to be wrong about that. And if he's wrong about the housing market and there is some kind of collapse of the housing bubble, then the U.S. economy would be in rather serious trouble. So he better hope he's right, or else things could get rather rocky in the coming months. He also cheered on the stunning increases in productivity, which have continued through a period of economic weakness. Another way of looking at that productivity gain is that we've seen growth rates and headline GDP numbers like 4 to 8%. At the same time, we're seeing virtually no job gains at all. If that's productivity, I don't know if it's such a great thing, but Greenspan seems to think it is. He's very concerned about the federal budget deficit, which he would like, I think, to see reduced through spending cuts. As a good right-winger, that's what he believes. He certainly didn't complain too much about the Bush tax cuts, that's not a very prudent thing for a central banker to do, but he is also has a long history as a partisan Republican. And he also doesn't seem to be too worried about the fact that the U.S. has been borrowing very heavily abroad to keep our economy expanding. Massive inflows of foreign capital, $2 billion every business day, have been what's been funding all the borrowing against housing, all the borrowing against credit cards, that ultimately has been financed by foreign investors and foreign central banks. The Chinese central bank now is one of the major buyers of U.S. Treasury securities, it's very ironic that what we used to call Red China is the major prop to U.S. economic activity these days, but there is a kind of dual dependency between the two economies. We buy their very cheap exports, and they buy our very prestigious treasury bonds that keep the whole cycle going. Couple of other points. It was also announced today that Comcast, the cable television giant, is making an offer to buy Disney, the home entertainment giant, this has prompted a lot of the usual worries about media concentration. And while those are important, I would also want to argue that that's not the whole story, that concentration is only one part of the story. I think what really is what makes our media so stupid and vulgar and embarrassing so often is not so much the concentration, not the ownership, but the fact that they're organized for the maximum maximization of profit. And to do that, you need to maximize the audience. And to do that, you need to appeal to the lowest common denominator. And the only way to get out of that paradigm is, I don't think if you break up these media giants, you're not going to see that much of a change. We've had dumb media in this country for a very, very long time. I'm not quite sure when people think things were considerably better than they are right now. I think what we need to do is alternative models of ownership, nonprofit ownership, and community broadcasting, very much like this radio station. And since we're not driven by a profit motive or audience maximization, we're insulated from the stupefying pressures of competitive markets. So that's a roundabout way of saying make good on your pledge. And thank you, for those of you who have, for supporting WBAI. And now, an interview I recorded about a week ago with the author of High and Mighty, The Dangerous Rise of the SUV. That's Keith Bradshaw, who is a New York Times reporter. Spent 5 or 6 years as the Detroit bureau chief of the newspaper, where he learned a lot about the auto industry, wrote a lot about the SUV for that paper. He is now now in Hong Kong, covering that part of the world for the New York Times. But he has just come out with the paperback edition of the book High and Mighty, with new material in it. The publisher is Public Affairs Books. And here's Keith Bradshaw talking about the sport utility vehicle, and a little apology for the radiator in my office was making a lot of noise during part of this interview, so I was managed to strip some of that out by putting a high filter on the thing, but the consequences of that were several minutes of somewhat muffled sounding voices, but did get that radiator noise mostly out of it. So here is Keith Bradshaw. Sport utility vehicles now are so ubiquitous. Where and when do they come from?
There have been sport utility vehicles going all the way back to the 1930s, but they didn't really take off until the government in the 1970s set more strict standards for cars than it did for light trucks. And the auto industry, using its lobbying influence and muscle in Washington, got the sport utility vehicles classified as light trucks. So they don't have to meet the same safety standards as the cars. They don't have to meet the same air pollution standards as the cars. They don't have to meet the same fuel economy standards as the cars. And the auto industry then has taken these less safe, more polluting, more gas-guzzling vehicles and increased their share of the American market from 1% back in the 1970s to nearly 30% today.
What's the overall impact of SUVs on fuel consumption in the U.S.?
SUVs are absolutely increasing our reliance on imported oil and on oil often from environmentally affected areas. They're getting about one quarter worse fuel economy than cars to one-third worse fuel economy. In turn, transportation, mainly cars, are about two-fifths of our total energy consumption. So they are increasing total energy consumption by total oil consumption by a few percentage points, but that's significant because every point at the margin, a percentage point at the margin, tends to be the ones that are imported or that you're really pushing into the more ecologically fragile areas.
And what about the impact of emissions, roughly the same?
Exactly. And then you also have an effect, of course, on global warming. The biggest thing to remember, though, is that we haven't seen the full effect now in terms of the absolute percentages, because the proportion of all vehicles on the road that are SUVs hasn't caught up with how many new SUVs that are being sold now. You've still got so many cars on the road from the 1970s, some, and particularly the 1980s, that as those get replaced by these new model years that have so many SUVs, we're really going to see a lot of SUVs in the next 10 years. The problem is going to get a lot worse. We're going to end up with much higher oil consumption than we otherwise would have had.
And you mentioned the industry's lobbying muscle in Congress. Could you talk a bit about how they managed to get these now ubiquitous vehicles exempt from so many regulations?
The company that really made the difference, and I didn't appreciate this until I did the research for the book. I didn't appreciate it quite when I was still with writing about this for the Times. The company that made the difference was the American Motors Corporation, AMC. AMC bought Jeep in 1970, which was still owned by the Kaiser family. Henry Kaiser had bought it after the war, after World War II. The American Motors was in very bad shape in the 1970s. There was a worry that they would go bust in the face of Japanese competition, the fact that they weren't ready for the high gas prices and the new pollution standards. And so Washington was bending over backwards to try to find ways to rescue them. The one part of American Motors that was doing well was Jeep. And so as the head of the Air Pollution Office of the Environmental Protection Agency put it to me when I was doing my book research, he said, we could not afford to have the bankruptcy of American Motors blamed on the Clean Air Act. And so what did they do? They put the SUVs into the light truck category for air pollution. To this day, SUVs are allowed to pollute as much as 5 times as much per mile as a car. And following that decision, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration ended up putting SUVs into the light truck category for safety standards, fuel economy, and all these other categories. But the first precedent was under the Clean Air Act.
I guess one of the appeals to buyers of these things is they're allegedly safer. Tell us about the balance of power and the safety aspects. Maybe safer for drivers, but what about people who might have an unwelcome intersection with an SUV?
Actually, one of the myths is that the SUVs are safer for drivers. They're not. The death rate for people in SUVs is as high or higher than it is for cars. People in SUVs die just as often as people in cars. They just die differently. The people in SUVs tend to die in rollovers. 3/5 of all deaths in SUVs are in rollovers. Now, with such a high rollover death rate, how is it that the SUVs don't have a much higher death rate than cars overall? The reason is that they're very good at transferring the force of impact to the other guy in a vehicle-to-vehicle crash because they ride over the bumpers and door sills of the cars they hit. And so they're making up for their own high death rate in rollovers by really creaming the other guy in the vehicle-to-vehicle crashes. They triple the death rate in other vehicles they hit compared with if those other vehicles had been hit by cars instead. So really what's going on here is that the SUVs, by being more dangerous vehicles, are raising society's death rate, but they're doing it by raising everybody else's death rate, by killing the other guy, without providing any greater safety and death rate for the SUV occupants. Finally, I think something that a lot of people don't realize is you really have to worry about paralysis in an SUV. Rollovers account for 1% of all traffic accidents. They account for 25% of traffic deaths, and they account for the majority of paralysis cases resulting from auto accidents. Why is that? Because paralysis tends to come from neck and head injuries, and it's when you flip a vehicle over that you're particularly likely to start getting those neck and head injuries.
You created quite a splash, as I recall, with a story in the Times about personality type of the SUV buyer, and this research is in the book as well. Who buys these things and why?
SUVs are marketed to baby boomers with a variety of insecurities, a variety of concerns. I've often been accused of somehow being very critical myself of SUV buyers, but let me just read instead rather than what the auto industry thinks of the people who buy their SUVs. Here's what David Bostwick, the market research director at Chrysler, told me. He said, quote, "We have a basic resistance in our society to admitting that we are parents and no longer able to go out and find another mate. If you have a sport utility, you can have the smoked windows, put the children in the back, and pretend you're still single," unquote. He also said, quote, "Sport utility people say, I already have 2 kids, I don't need 20. Then we talk to the people who have minivans and they say, quote, I don't have 2 kids, I have 20, all the kids in the neighborhood," unquote. So the point of Chrysler's market research is that people who buy SUVs tend to be less confident in their marriages, according to the market research, and they tend to be less comfortable with parenthood. People who buy SUVs, according to the auto industry, are also people who are more concerned with how other people see them with their images than they are with practicality. As Honda's executive vice president for North American auto operations puts it, quote, "The people who buy SUVs are in many cases buying the outside first and then the inside. They are buying the image of the SUV first and then the functionality." Or to, unquote. And then the Ed Golden, the design director for Ford brand vehicles, quote, "It's an image vehicle, an SUV. It says something about your lifestyle." So there are example after example of that from the market research of the automakers. In 6 years as Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, I talked to all these market researchers many times and to the design directors for various models. And they're very blunt about how these are vehicles that are status symbols rather than vehicles that, for the most part, are being purchased for their actual off-road use or use in towing trailers. There are some people who buy them for that, but they're not the majority.
Most people don't have that as part of their daily life. What about the, in many ways, the most egregious SUV of all, the Hummer? And you've got a bit about Arnie and the launch of that. Tell us about Arnie, the Hummer, and how this military vehicle became such a hit.
I have a chapter in this new book, High and Mighty, the paperback edition, which is an expanded edition, and the chapter is entitled The Schwarzenegger Dividend. Arnold Schwarzenegger played a central role. He was filming the movie Kindergarten Cop back in 1991 during the Persian Gulf War, and he saw a convoy of military Humvees. He had his one of his managers call up the manufacturer, AM General, and insist that he get one. AM General initially said, well, we can't give you one. It's a military vehicle. It doesn't meet the standards for going on a road. He said, well, fix it so it does. And he ended up talking them into selling a passenger vehicle. The rights to the Hummer brand have since been purchased from AM General by General Motors, which has a lot of marketing muscle. And that's how you start seeing now these Hummer H2s, and now there'll be a Hummer H3. It's turning into a mass market brand. It's catering to people actually who tend not to have served in the military, but who tend to have very strong concerns about their self-image as well. The head of marketing for Hummer likes to talk about what kind of buyers they want. And for the Hummer H1, they're appealing to individualists. But for the Hummer H2, they're looking more for people who, as the head of market research puts it, are rugged individualists, but people who really seek out peer approval. They tend to be people who are willing to put big bets on fast-moving stocks, but aren't going to be actually taking it off-road. So that's the kind of people that GM is trying to cater to with the Hummer H2. And in fact, for that reason, their number one target market is the New York City market.
I'm speaking with Keith Bradshaw, author of the book High and Mighty, The Dangerous Rise of the SUV, just out in paperback from Public Affairs Books. Oh, but it sounds like the kinds of people with these vehicles appeal to are macho guys who are secretly anxious about just how masculine they really are. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, that's your characterization. I've never had General Motors say that, but General Motors does say it's about people who are deeply concerned about how others see them and really want to impress other people, even though they're not in lifestyles and don't have hobbies that would normally justify their needing this kind of a extremely capable off-road vehicle.
Are the buyers mostly men, or women buy these things too?
Very heavily men for the Hummer, but women overall are now half of SUV buyers.
These are, from a point of view of policy, should be disastrous, right? They're dangerous, polluting, gas guzzlers, politically, are they invincible?
They're almost politically invincible. Now, we have seen, to its credit, an effort by the Bush administration in the last year to address this. The head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is a former emergency room doctor who came to the job without anybody really knowing it, that he came to the job with a deep dissatisfaction with the way he was seeing people brought in from cars maimed by SUVs that had come over the bumpers, even though the people in the cars had their seatbelts on, the airbags working, and so forth. And he'd also seen the rollover paralysis cases and so forth. And he has really been telling the industry, you've got to clean up its act. So there have been some steps, some positive steps. I have a new chapter in the paperback edition that was not in the original edition on some of these recent moves. The industry is doing something to try to address rollovers. It's doing some things to try to improve crash compatibility so they don't override the bumpers quite so much in the cars. The efforts are not enough. They're a step in the right direction. Now, that said, people can and should be taking more steps themselves to protect themselves. For example, if you must buy an SUV, and there are all kinds of reasons why you'd be safer in a large car, but if you must buy an SUV, definitely get one with the electronic stability control, which reduces your chances of a rollover. Definitely get one with side airbags that go up and protect your head as well. That'll improve your chances of not being paralyzed. Definitely remember that four-wheel drive does not help you stop. Four-wheel drive just means the power from the engine's going to all four wheels, but you have no better brakes. In fact, you usually have worse brakes than you do in a car. Until the 2003 model year, Federal government standards did not require SUVs to meet the same braking standards as cars. This is a big, heavy vehicle, and if you start trying to stop on ice or snow, you're going to go a lot farther than you would in a car. And you may, unfortunately, be going faster because you haven't been slipping and sliding as you accelerate because of the four-wheel drive.
Now, these kinds of adjustments may mitigate the risk of the vehicles, but I would guess that people buy them because they look kind of like Bradley assault vehicles, right? So I mean, how much can you do to make them better without really turning them into a VW bug?
You can do things beneath the exterior sheet metal that do make them less of a menace. Now, it's going to take a long time to redesign these vehicles to make them less of a menace. For example, the voluntary agreement by 15 automakers on four continents in November to make them a little less dangerous to cars takes effect in 2007 for half the SUVs and 2009 for the rest of them. But what they're going to do is they're going to lower the stiffest elements inside the front end of an SUV, back behind the bumper where you can't see it. They're going to either lower the frame rails, which are the underpinnings of the vehicle, or they will put almost like a cow catcher, sort of a stiff steel bar, hollow steel bar actually, below and behind the bumper to help catch the front end of the car and keep it from sliding underneath the SUV.
And finally, I imagine that you probably touched some nerves with this book. Tell us what kinds of reaction. People hostile? Feel like you're attacking their personality as well as their vehicle choice?
I've gotten a hostile reaction from some SUV owners, but a lot of SUV owners really are interested in safety, and when I talk to them, they understand. The real effort has been made by the auto industry. As I describe in the new chapter of the paperback, when the hardcover came out, the auto industry's main Washington lobbying firm produced a 15-page, unsigned, no-letterhead attack on the book, which they then circulated to book reviewers, auto writers, radio talk show hosts, and so forth, and really pummeled me with it. It was the kind of thing that the auto industry has been doing for years. They bankroll something now called the Sport Utility Vehicle Owners of America by advertising with this group that was actually set up by their favorite lobbying firm. And that puts up various attacks on my book, as well as attacks on anybody who criticizes SUVs. They do it through mailings and website and so forth and media interviews. So they're very, very active in going after anybody who questions this shift towards SUVs.
And that was Keith Bradshaw, who is the author of the book High and Mighty, The Dangerous Rise of the SUV, recently published, just out in paperback, rather, from Public Affairs Books. And this is WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And we'll be back to talk with Michael Mann after this word from the New York Dolls.
And you're a prima ballerina on a spring.
The New York Dolls and their classic Personality Crisis. And if you've got a personality crisis, just buy an SUV. That'll take care of it. And we're back here. My name is Doug Henwood. Behind the News is the show. And we're joined by Michael Mann, who is a distinguished sociologist, teaches at UCLA, and author of a book out just out from Verso called Incoherent Empire. And Empire word on many lips lately. Welcome to WBAI, Michael Mann.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why is this empire coherent? When you look at George Bush, he seems to have that focused, steely gaze. He seems to think it's pretty coherent.
Well, I think he's being disabused of that gradually. My general argument is that the U.S. has less power than the administration seems to think, and that its different forms of power are very uneven, so that there's an obviously great military power, especially of offensive devastation, and that's what seduced the administration into invading foreign countries and attempting to restructure them. But even in the military realm, we don't have a great amount of power of pacification, of actually pacifying the country afterwards. And though the people around the Bush administration often talk about this being a new empire, obviously for good, they say, we lack some of the powers of former empires. And it's obvious that in Iraq, for example, we simply don't have enough troops. The British in the 19th century used to calculate that if you wanted to pacify a country, you had to have about 2.5 times the number of troops that you needed to conquer it in the first place, because they too had offensive devastation powers. But once your troops have taken the capital, conquered their enemy army, then they have to disperse through the country. And that needs more, and they become more vulnerable, and they become more vulnerable to lower caliber weapons like Kalashnikovs. And so the military power isn't quite there. But actually, what previous empires did was not have lots and lots of their own forces. They used local allies. And the real unilateral blunder of the U.S. was the political unilateralism. We're moving over to political power, was not so much to ignore the Europeans and the U.N. as to have no local allies, apart from the Kurds in the north.
Well, they thought they had people like Chalabi, who, of course,
right.
not much of a base inside Iraq itself.
Absolutely, and that's the problem. The only people on the council who do have some kind of base are some of the Shia, and they have their own game to play. They're not particularly pro-American.
Yeah, you do have a little review of some of the earlier strategies of imperial subjugation.
Yes.
And the use of local partners was quite interesting. Could you talk a bit, for example, about the British in India, how they managed to run
yes.
that country for so long?
Right. Well, the British had 250,000 troops in India, but only 50 to 70,000 of them were British. The vast majority were Indian. And in Africa, only 10% of the troops were British. 90% were African. And in order to pacify the country and rule it, they extensively used local allies. And this is, in a way, a first. Vietnam was not like this, because we went in aiding what we thought was a pretty powerful state with an army. But we go into Iraq with only the Kurds in the north. And so we're short of soldiers, either our soldiers or their soldiers. And now we are actually withdrawing somewhat. Our troops are being moved back into smaller, larger bases, and we're leaving the Iraqi police to take the brunt of it. And they're simply not well enough equipped or organized to be able to do it. We're unable to impose order. We've overestimated our powers to bring order to this country, and more or less the same story would be true of the other rogue states, in quotes. This is no longer the Age of Empires. And there's something underlying why we have difficulty in finding local allies. It isn't just a mistake. It's that this is the age of nationalism and anti-imperialism.
Well, how were the British able to cultivate so many friends in India and elsewhere?
Well, I mean, they weren't faced with nationalism, with national identity. They weren't the inhabitants of India, our term, not theirs. They didn't think of themselves as Indians. They thought of themselves, they had particular ethnic identities, regional identities. And when a foreign conqueror comes in and conquers your lord, you have to decide whether you're going to carry on supporting that your former lord or whether you switch sides to the British. And there's no one's called a traitor to the nation if they collaborate with the British, because it's to their advantage. Now, obviously, there might be a lot of people in Iraq who would like to cooperate with the U.S., but they're in danger of being attacked as traitors to the nation. And though Shia and Sunni and Kurds, it's not a single conception of a nation. It's not like Vietnam, where we were opposed by a single national liberation movement. They, as much as they dislike each other, they dislike us more, because it is the ideology of the world that all nations should govern themselves.
Yeah, and the nationalist ideology was imported from Europe
by
the anti-colonial struggle,
That's
ironically
right.
enough.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned also the example of the Germans in Africa who didn't really use local partners, and in consequence, they were quite brutal.
Yes. They still used some, but they had at least 30% of their armed forces were German rather than 10%, which was the African norm. And they were the most brutal, especially in places like Southwest Africa, where they essentially committed a genocide because they lacked the local allies.
What is, you're a sociologist, so what accounts, what are the social ideological roots of this difference between the U.S. approach and, say, the British approach? Is there something in British social structure or practice that made them more appropriate to the practices of running an empire?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just that they lived in the 19th century and we live in the 20th century. An empire is no longer possible in quite the same way. It is true, however, that people coming back from the two sectors in Iraq, and they say that what the Brits do is what they've done for hundreds of years, which is to go into a village and say, who's the boss here? And they get this guy and they say, okay, we'll support you if you support us. It's got nothing to do with democracy, but it is a little more effective as a basis of order, but they have an easier sector anyway.
Let's switch a bit, but Perry Anderson, the editor of New Left Review, who I think is a good friend of yours also,
yeah,
had a piece about a year ago in the Review and also, I think, reprinted in Counterpunch, arguing that the Bush administration didn't represent that much of a departure from previous American policy. He didn't quite understand why they were exciting all this opposition, why the millions of people were getting to the streets, protesting something that looked to him like something the United States had done for decades before. Does it strike you that there's something different about the Bush administration, that this sense of alarm is justified, or is it really just more of the same?
Well, in some ways it's the same. That is, it's not the first time that the U.S. has intervened in foreign countries. But by and large, the U.S. has intervened more indirectly than directly during the Cold War, propping up oligarchies, conservatives, militaries, against their local leftist opponents. And so in that period, the U.S. always had, well, when it was successful, it always had strong local allies, and it was dividing the country between on class and political lines. Now we have a kind of national rather than a class division. I mean, more than that, we have in effect made Muslims our enemies in all kinds of ways. And so given that and everything that's going on, the quite naked support for Israel now, the Guantanamo Bay, the rounding up of young Muslim immigrants to the U.S., and the killing in Afghanistan and Iraq, all of these make it virtually impossible for us to operate in that way. Even the most reactionary Arab regimes want to distance themselves from us a bit. And so what's new is the attempt to territorially control countries ourselves, regardless of the locals. And though it's true that there were the doctrine of a preemptive strikes and the like, there were some anticipations of it in the 1990s. I don't think that a Democratic administration would have quite moved to that. Of course, it's difficult because 9/11 then intervened, and 9/11 gave the possibility of popularly mobilizing Americans behind these policies. And so that was a dramatic shift and did result from an attack on us.
And I should clarify, when you say us, you're both a British and an American citizen. So, right?
Yeah, well, I have two citizenships, yes. And so the we is an unusually broad we here. Yeah. I wrote the book because I got so angry with the foreign policies of my two governments and felt that I had certain kind of skills from my scholarship to bring in support of saying why it wouldn't work. So by and large, the book isn't a moral denunciation of policies, but it's a denunciation in terms of it can't work. It's going to be a disaster. It's going to produce blowback. We're producing more terrorists. We're not doing anything against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We're not going to bring order to Iraq. It ain't going to work.
I'm speaking with Michael Mann, who is the author of Incoherent Empire, just out from Verso. What do you think the Bush administration hopes to accomplish with this imperial policy? Is there some, are there social interests in the United States that will somehow profit off this empire? Is it political ambition? Is it some sort of macho fantasy? What's behind this?
Well, very few are actually going to profit from it because it's not going to work. It's not working. But they may have thought that they would. It's difficult to work out the exact motivations. There are a number of motives. Some of them ideal, in a way, about ideals. Some of them not so ideal. Some of them are strategic. I think perhaps the main one, and the why Iraq question, it is partly about oil, but then if it's only about oil, the sensible thing to do is to make friends with those who got oil, because they need to sell it to you as well. I think the main thing is as a kind of exemplary sign to other states. They thought we could roll over Iraq, and that'll discipline all the rest of them. And so it's partly about Iraq, and there are reasons. We wanted to move out of Saudi Arabia. We want bases in Iraq instead. We want the oil and these kinds of things. But also it's this more general signal to the other states, which if it had worked, that would have worked. But it hasn't worked.
Well, I've thought many times over the last couple of years that that this was kind of excessive, and that the American business, political, and intellectual elites would object and rein the Bush administration in some way. Do you see any division within the American elite that might lead to that kind of outcome?
Well, I don't see any as yet. I don't think it's actually economically driven. As I say, I don't think oil is a sufficient motive. Economic motives are part of it, and there's obviously a military-industrial nexus strongly connected to Israel. There's a lot of profit to be got from Israel. And there's obviously these interests, which are a mixture of economic and political. But as yet, however, I would assume that there are no public signs of this, I don't think. But I assume that there would be worry among, you know, Wall Street and the like, because if we really do get bogged down in Iraq and elsewhere for several years and run these enormous deficits, then the rest of the world might lose a bit of confidence in American leadership of the world economy, and we might end up with the dollar not as the only reserve currency, and something like that would be a disaster. So I assume that there would be some movement at some point among elites.
I'm going to be seeing George Soros at the Council on Foreign Relations next week, so I'll see what happens there and see what take the soundings of that elite body. You cite one of my favorite quotations from our president during the 2000 campaign when he said, "When I was coming up, we knew who the enemy was, and now we don't know who the enemy is, but we know he's out there somewhere." And, you know, on September 11th, Bush found that floating enemy and kind of fixed it in his little head. But he seems to treat, you know, this the enemy as, you know, capital T, capital E, this one unitary force, the terrorist, as if they're just, you know, one unitary body. You look some at the composition of these. You talk about the national and internationalist tendencies among, you know, various terrorist groupies. Could you just give a little lay of the land of the, what Bush thinks is just one it's undifferentiated unity?
Well, I divide. I mean, obviously, firstly, terrorists are their counterpart is state terrorists, and they're normally involved in violence against each other and a mutual violence. But I distinguish between national and international terrorists. And national terrorists are those who, they call themselves national liberation fighters, and they're fighting against their local oppressor, like Hamas, Hezbollah, various other Chechens, etc. And they don't attack us. Hamas and Hezbollah have not actually attacked any Americans since 1983 or 5. 1985, perhaps, when we were in the Lebanon. But since Al-Qaeda obviously are attacking us, they're the international terrorists. That is, they've moved out from their localities. These are all exiles, essentially. They tried to take on the Egyptian state, the Saudi state, the Yemeni state, the Algerian state, and they were defeated, and they moved out to the West, and then they decided that their enemy was also the Soviet Union and then the United States. Now, these are attacking us, and obviously we have to retaliate in some way. But the administration, in its list of terrorist organizations, always runs the two together. You'll find them saying, you'll find Bush or Cheney saying Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Jaish al-Mohammed, Laskar al-Taiba from, you know, Kashmir or Indonesia or wherever, and running them together. And this is extremely foolish. Why attack people who are not attacking us? And right now, Hamas and Hezbollah are having these disputes within them. Well, shouldn't we attack the United States now since they're attacking us? And so far, the leadership has said no. but we're creating more enemies. And we invade Muslim countries, we're creating more terrorists who have negative views against us, and some of whom are attacking us. We're clearly creating new terrorists. Our military officers in Iraq are saying now Al-Qaeda-associated people are active in Iraq. Well, of course, they weren't before, at least only with the Kurdish-controlled area in the north. And in the bombings of Casablanca and Riyadh, half these bombers were young men aged between 22 and 25, and in the Riyadh case, some of them had only just left university. And these are new people, new recruits. So we're creating more than we're destroying, I believe. The international terrorists could be fought quite easily with international collaboration, because when they bomb in Bali, they kill more Indonesians than they do Australians or Americans. And so the Indonesian government is converted to the notion that they have to go after them. So virtually every government of the world is going after them. And if we were only focused on Al-Qaeda, I'm sure they could be defeated in a relatively short period of time because of this international security effort. But we're creating more terrorists.
And you say that this is not going to work, and you talk some of the reasons being the creation of instability and creation of more terrorists, but you also think that the economic basis of the U.S. Strength is weaker than it might appear on the surface. Why do you think that?
Well, we have the wealth to do it if we want to, but I don't think that the American people really do want to spend a lot more, because it's being underfunded. If the administration really wants to bring order to Iraq, it has to spend a lot more. And I don't think Americans are quite willing to do that, because fundamentally Americans are not imperialists as a whole. It doesn't have a popular resonance. That's one aspect of it. And the other aspect is the precariousness, potential precariousness of the U.S. as the dominant economy, the dollar as the reserve currency. It could easily turn into, there is a process of long-term relative decline by the U.S., obviously, because the U.S. was so dominant in the 50s and 60s. And with the rise of China and India on top of the rest of East Asia, clearly our role in the world economy is going to decline somewhat. And if we get engaged in these ventures, then the economic base for it is going to whittle away.
And I wanted to pick up on a point you made earlier. You mentioned that terrorists or bombers who had just left university. And that's an interesting point, that some of the social origins of suicide bombers are not in deep impoverishment. They tend to be educated and middle class.
Yes, they do.
Could you talk a bit about the social background of terrorists?
Yes. The first major group of terrorists in recent times, was in Sri Lanka, and the Tamil Tigers. And they, too, tended to be relatively well-educated as being young, and a number of them were women as well as men. And this is also true of most of the Middle Eastern terrorists. And these are people who have political ideals. And I think that, indeed, the extreme Islamism has risen and fallen several times in the course of the 20th century, and it is related to imperialism. It rose in the 1920s against British and French imperialism, and it rose against Soviet imperialism in Afghanistan, and now it's rising against American. So we have to imagine these people as well-read, well-educated, knowledgeable about the world, and they are principled opponents of us, and they see themselves as anti-imperialists as well as Islamists.
But the American impulse is, of course, to see them as ignorant primitives.
That's right, yes.
Which is exactly the wrong kind of response.
Absolutely, you're right.
So you think that the kinds of policies the Bush administration is pursuing are just going to make the political environment worse?
Yes, I do. And unfortunately, I don't see any way out in Iraq. I think this is very bad news for Iraqis. It's not very good news for Americans either, but it's even worse for Iraqis. And it's difficult to see what's going to happen. But I think that our goals are being unraveled right now.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Michael Mann. Michael Mann is the author of Incoherent Empire, just out from Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this old Cure song, which somehow explores the secret affinities between the Bush administration, French existentialists, and English aesthetes.
I'm alive.